Come 906.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Human interest in dolphins started long before SeaWorld, long before Flipper. We probably began to take notice and feel an affection for these charismatic creatures from the moment we could build a boat and take to the seas. They are one of the most beloved animals in human history. Depictions of dolphins can be found as far back as the 4th century before Christ. A later illustration of an official connection to dolphins to humans, of dolphins to humans, dates back to 1349, when the heir to the French throne was given the title Le Dauphin, the dolphin, and the sea mammal was placed on the prince's crest. That's just one of the things you'll learn about dolphins in Dr. Alan Roach's book, simply titled Dolphin. It explores the evolution, life, and culture of dolphins, and it turns out that despite our attraction to and affection for this animal, we don't really know all that much about it. But thanks to Dr. Roach, you'll soon know a lot more, and he joins us for the hour, and I apologize for saying your name incorrectly in the opening minute of the program. Welcome back.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Yours is the first nonfiction book that has come across this desk, and I cannot tell you how long, without a subtitle. It's simply called Dolphin. How did you get away with that?
It comes out of a series where all of the books in the series are named simply after the animal. So in
how
some
refreshing.
Sense, yes, and, so, and God knows I've written so many essays and a couple of books that have long subtitles that it was really refreshing for me to get away from it. But when people ask me, what's the name of the book, and I say Dolphin, there's this pause, and they want to know more.
Yeah, I'm surprised the publisher didn't make you say something like the complete history of
right.
and culture surrounding the animal that we've come to love.
Right, or to begin it as the dolphin or how, dot, dot, dot.
You spent a lot of time writing, and we talked about this when you were here before, about other topics. You've taken it upon yourself to reprint a few books from way, way earlier in our printed history, a couple mm-hmm. hundred years old. You've written about the influence of science and literature in the England of 1815. That's pretty obscure. You've written essays on the structure of Bruce Springsteen's music. Did you go to the concert the other night?
Oh, man. That was the – every time I'm just taken aback by how remarkable. Were you there?
No. Oh. And you've also written about the science found in Frankenstein. But this book, it takes you back to an earlier interest. How did you first become interested in dolphins? It goes a ways back.
Yeah. I grew up in Montreal, and so in some sense I had a stronger connection to not necessarily the marine world, but to kind of the ocean, because you're right on the St. Lawrence River in Montreal. It's an island. And I was very, very interested in zoology. I came from a kind of scientific family. I had a very strong interest in horses and animals of all kinds. And I got involved with something called the Montreal Zoological Society. And they ran expeditions up to a small town called Tadoussac, north of Quebec, on the St. Lawrence River. And in the St. Lawrence River, which is fairly low down because you're about 120 miles from Quebec, you can see enormous number of whales. I mean, amazing.
In the
whales.
River?
Yes, it's still saline enough so that the whales come down. But because the Saguenay River, which is a stunning river, comes in, it feeds a lot of freshwater fish, and so that there's a kind of confluence, and that's a perfect place. It's called an edge habitat, right? And that's why we find deer running along the side of the roads, because it's an edge habitat and there are mm-hmm. different kinds of things they can eat. And so I saw minke, say, blue, beluga whales are all over the place. And as a consequence of that, I got more interested in it. Then when Expo 67 came to Montreal, they built an aquarium in Montreal. And as a consequence, while I was doing my undergraduate degree at McGill, I had an opportunity to go and work there to do kind of an honors thesis. And that's sort of how it began.
And the honors thesis was on dolphins.
Right.
So is this an expansion?
Captivity.
Is this an expansion of that?
Well, it would be a very delayed expansion.
Yeah,
but in some sense, yes. Because then I went on to do a master's following up on that research on the behavior of dolphins in captivity, where I worked at a variety of aquaria throughout Florida and looked at a number of different kinds of environments These were all artificial environments, but some were actually quasi-natural, to study animals and develop a what was called an ethogram, a broader behavioral profile. So that was the sort of my grounding work in terms of working with dolphins scientifically. Over the years, because I switched over, got a PhD in literature, I decided to think about the cultural impact of animals. And so that in some sense, they've always been part of my intellectual life.
Now, you're a writer, but you have the science background, but you teach English at UNC Charlotte. And I understand that one of the reasons that you spend a lot of time writing about the intersection of science and technology and culture is because at some point in your life you realize that people who are really scientific and academically scientific are blind or to literature, and people who are into English and reading and the humanities just are like they're blocked. They can't see through the scientific barrier.
Right. And to some extent that's enforced by a university system that set up silos. We're trying more and more to break down those barriers. But when before I came to UNC Charlotte, I was at Georgia Tech, and we set up a degree in science, technology, and culture to bring those disciplines together. So I was an undergraduate. I was very interested. I wanted to be an artist. I was very interested in literature. I loved music. And here I was taking all these science courses that rigidified me and didn't allow me to take humanities courses unless I took them in my spare time, which I did. And then subsequently, I would meet my colleagues or friends in the humanities who were petrified about the sciences for no good reason, because the sciences were affecting everything they did in literature, but in some sense they had been flunked out for various reasons, because there's not enough room in a science class to keep all of the students, so you have to scare a number of them away. That, I think, is a wrong approach. I think what we need to do is encourage people to think interdisciplinarily all the time, and give them an opportunity to embrace science if they're in the humanities, and to appreciate the cultural impact that culture has in general on the sciences.
Well, this book reads in English. I mean, you can understand. It's scientific because you're learning all about their habits and their eating habits and their diving habits and their echolocation ability, etc. But it's not scientific in its terminology. You can actually understand it.
Right.
Could you have done the same thing about a bacterium?
I think so, absolutely. I mean, there are some wonderful science writers who are writing about this all the time. And, you know, in the book, not to scare people off, but I talk about some complicated things like the Reedy Mirabili, which is a network of veins or arteries that take high-pressure blood and diffuse it. And so that's a complicated Latin term, but the concept is very, very simple. It's exactly as I explained in the book. It's exactly the same as when you point a hose at somebody and it's the powerful flow from the hose pushes somebody back. But if you put your thumb on it, all of a sudden it's the same power coming through, but it diffuses. And think about blood going to your brain. If it came in a single blow, it would destroy brain cells. But if it is expanded, then in fact it allows the blood to flow easily.
I said, and I got this from your book, that dolphins are one of the most beloved animals in human history. I'll take you at your word for that, but I'd like you to tell me to put rank it up there with dogs and cats and horses.
Well, okay.
Or any other animal that we've come to know and love.
Well, since I love dogs and cats and horses as well, and my first love in terms of, I mean, I did have a dog when I was growing up. I have an 18-year-old dog right now who's listening to this at home, I hope. And I did a lot of horseback riding. It's a different, if I can use the expression, it's a different animal. In the sense that it's amazing how beloved the dolphin is, given that we can never live in proximity with it. Dogs and cats and other kinds of domestic animals, even oxen, those are animals we can live with cheek by jowl, so to speak. But we can't with the dolphin. And yet there it is, constantly coming up in mythology.
How do you explain that? Because you're right. Particularly earlier, when our ability to get into the ocean with any distance from the shore was fairly limited. And yet way, way, way back, there are illustrations of these creatures. There are myths surrounding these creatures. How do you explain that?
Well, it's a good question. And I think part of the answer is because of the dolphins' intelligence in general. And that is that there is this curiosity that they have when they come close to the shore. And a lot of dolphins live within a mile or two of the shore. There's a lot of it's an edge habitat again. They come in. And a lot of human communities fish. I mean, human communities don't necessarily stand on the shore. They go out there and they have this kind of interaction with them. But I think – so there's curiosity that's exchanged between humans and dolphins. And then I think that there is something very – I don't like to use the word magical, but I like the idea of them being elusive and attractive. So, for example, when I went up to – this is less about dolphins, but when you go up to whale watching, let's say in St. Lawrence River, these huge whales come out and they blow – and you know that they're air breathers, and then they disappear. And you think, no, I didn't really see that. And then they resurface again. And that appearance and disappearance is hypnotic.
Yeah.
And in fact, for the dolphin, in the early days of Christianity, the dolphin, which is no longer a major symbol in Christianity, the dolphin was an important symbol of the resurrection, partly because of that. It rises, breathes, it's alive, and then it disappears and it's gone.
And unlike whales and other fish,
whales are fish, no.
But they're not fish, but fish and whales, dolphins will, I guess, rise on their tail and chatter at you. They'll talk to you. They'll smile at you.
Well, when they're trained to do that, I don't
think they do that.
I don't think you're going to find, the dolphin rising up and swimming backwards and, you know, doing his, you know, chatter.
Uh-huh.
But they will chatter at you, and they will – you always do hear them. That's the other thing, is that they're so vocal that you either hear them making certain kinds of sounds like whistling, or if your head's underwater, if you ever have the opportunity to be in the water with dolphins, they're constantly buzzing you. I mean, people want to be in the water with dolphins, but frankly, it can be a scary process because you're constantly being echolocated.
Mm, and you can hear that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are frequencies that you can't hear.
Right.
But
and when they're echolocating you, what are they doing? Are they just figuring out what you are, who you are, what your intent is, how they should handle you, treat you, stay away from you, come close to you? What are they doing?
This is a great question, and it's part of the mystery of what we don't know about dolphins. Is we know that they have a very sophisticated echolocation system. We know it's at a very high frequency, higher frequencies than we typically use in our equipment. But when you think about, let's say, what you could do if you had an ultrasound machine and you were walking around down the street with it, you could tell if you met your friend, and you wouldn't have to ask her or him whether they had lunch because you would see that their stomach is full.
Mm.
A dolphin can tell that you are a mammal when you're in the water because it sees auditorily that you have lungs. There's these large spaces, not unlike the large spaces that it's in their comrade dolphin.
Right.
They can tell if there's a broken bone or if you're ill. All of those things I'm speculating, but we know that they have the capability of doing that. If you're pregnant and there's a fetus developing inside of you, then clearly that is going the same way we use ultrasound to determine that. Or if you have a tumor. So there's a whole vocabulary of understanding each other that dolphins have that is completely inaccessible to us, except now that we have this new equipment.
Okay. We're going to come back and talk more about not only what they can do, but their culture, because they do have a culture, how they live, how they interact with each other, and a heck of a lot more about dolphins with Dr. Alan Roach with UNC Charlotte and the author of the book. And I'm going to slow down so you'll get this, Dolphin. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Donald Hack Diamonds, serving Charlotte for over 30 years with fine diamonds, engagement rings, custom design, and jewelry for all occasions. Donald Hack Diamonds, Sharon Road, across from South Park Mall, and DonaldHack.com. And Gallery at Green Hill in downtown Greensboro, presenting select collection prints of Romare Bearden, tomorrow with panel discussions open to the public and a ticketed reception. Details at greenhillnc.org. Last year, Mecklenburg County's Department of Social Services received 14,000 reports of possible abuse and neglect of children. If that number sounds high, that's because it is, and it's higher than the year before. So they've launched a campaign with other agencies to help people understand the signs, help them spot the signs of child abuse and neglect, and perhaps prevent it. And we'll talk about what they're doing Monday at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, the Supreme Court upholds a Michigan law banning affirmative action. The FCC announces plans for new net neutrality rules. And Georgia's governor signs an expansive gun carry law.
Join the Diane Rehm Show in the News Roundup this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. Our guest today is Dr. Alan Roach, professor of English, UNC Charlotte, but the author of Dolphin. He has a zoology background and has done extensive studies into the lifestyle and habits of dolphins. And he also worked, you said a few minutes ago that you worked in your college years at various aquaria around Florida, studying not only dolphins but other things. And I'm curious about that because we have taken these animals and made them circus performers. We've taken them and put them in captivity. And partly it's because we have this love affair. But is our love affair with these animals doing them any good?
Well, that's a good question, and it's the subject of a lot of controversy right now. In fact, the mayor of Vancouver, I just happen to know this because I read more Canadian news.
That's right. You're a Canadian.
Yeah, than other people typically do. But he stated that he wanted the Stanley Aquarium, Stanley Park Aquarium, which is a famous and, you know, one of the first marine mammal aquaria, to stop keeping dolphins in captivity. They stopped keeping killer whales. And, of course, blackfish has been very important in removing killer whales from captivity, although they're still a great attraction and they're still in captivity. But dolphins it's a difficult kind of thing to think about a dolphin in being captive in a room, let's say the size of this studio, which is pretty small, for its entire life, with the same kind of flat surfaces. They're echolocating animals. They love diversity of textures. And to some extent, yes, they bring them very close to us, and we've done some things that are worse than others. For example, putting them in petting pools where people congregate around them and there's no place for them to escape and people are reaching out and touching them. Yeah. If they're going to be kept in captivity in a decent facility, then, of course, I think they should be trained in the sense that it's what's called behavioral enrichment. We should, in fact, keep them active. That's our responsibility, not just keep them on display. But the question of whether they really need to be in captivity or should be in captivity or whether we learn anything from them in captivity. And can I give you one example?
Sure.
So I worked in these aquaria. And one of the places that I worked, which was a large facility, I would stay on the lower level looking through some of the portholes so I could monitor the behavior. I had a lot of technical equipment that I kept to track behaviors and keep my data. But ultimately, I had to take breaks. And when I took breaks, people would come downstairs from having just seen them perform these spectacular things that they can do and having gone through a show. And usually the show has costumes and all sorts of apparatus, and it's kind of cheesy in a way. They come down and they talk to me if I'm on break. And the amazing thing is how many people ask very, very rudimentary questions. So they've had this whole exposure, and they still don't know, how do I tell one from the other? It's pretty easy to do once you look at them. How can I tell a male from a female? What's that dimple in the middle of them? It's a belly button. Where are their ears? All of these questions that are basic and fundamental, and they've just walked away from a very expensive show and don't know any of the rudimentary things that actually they're very curious, especially children. They're very curious about. And so I think often patrons are ill-served by these aquaria.
Yeah. Well, let's start with some basics then. A dolphin is not a porpoise, although we sometimes use the terms interchangeably. So what's the difference?
Okay. Well, one of the things I will say when we say dolphin, it comprehends a huge group, but we'll, the porpoises are typically smaller. They have, there's a nitpicking detail, which is that they have flat blade-like teeth, whereas dolphins have pointy conical teeth. Dolphins more often than not have some kind of beak, but not always, it's called a rostrum, and they're usually longer or bigger. Mm-hmm. They're much more social. They seem to be more gregarious. But otherwise, aside from the teeth, there's not really a huge – and behavior, there's not a huge distinction that you would really know. But we don't typically train porpoises. The term – porpoise and dolphin was interchangeable probably up until fairly recently.
Now, you mentioned the beak, and that's commonly
the bottlenose dolphin,
which is the one that we see. It's Flipper.
Right.
It's Flipper. And you call them metropolitan creatures because they're in every ocean in mm-hmm. the world, and they are not just bottlenose dolphins.
No.
How many different types of dolphins are there?
Well, we believe that there are 27 different species. Mm-hmm. And I say we believe in the sense that sometimes these species look so much alike that the only way that we can tell the difference is by some kind of genetic analysis.
Do they interbreed?
That's a good question, too. Some probably do interbreed, but because they're isolated geographically, there's not a lot of opportunity for them to do that.
Are their habits from species to species relatively similar, or are they different in many ways?
Well, they can be. Sometimes they can be analogous in the sense that you have one species that's coastal and another species elsewhere that's coastal, and they behave the same way, whereas you have another two species that are what are called pelagic, in open water, and they can behave the same way, even though they've just adjusted to similar environments and adapted to them. So in certain kinds of situations, there is a possibility, and this is getting to culture, they can transfer certain kinds of behaviors that they've learned or adapted. For example, most recently, there's been a lot of discussion about them using sponges. Not over-the-counter sponges, but the sponges you find on the ocean floor, because there are certain fish that they can't really see or hear with their echolocation because it's too stony and rough. And fish that like sole, flatfish that have very, very little room in them for like an air bladder are very hard to determine. But if you want to muck around in the stones, the only way you can do that is to use your beak. And dolphins often have roughed up beaks, but they're not going to get them roughed up anymore. So what they do is they find a sponge, bite on it, move stones around, and dig up the fish that they are looking for.
They're using a tool.
Yeah.
What do we say about creatures that use tools? Is that a sign of intelligence?
Sophistication and intelligence. Uh-huh. Intelligence is a very difficult.
Yeah.
We have enough trouble finding out what intelligence means amongst humans, never mind across species. And intelligence varies, I think.
Right. They travel, or their social interaction is in pods.
Mm-hmm.
That's a herd of dolphins, pod of dolphins. How many animals in a pod? Do they leave their pods and form new pods? Do they associate with animals from other pods? Do they intermingle, or do they just stick to their own families?
Again, this kind of demographic information is really all emerging now, and mm-hmm. people are – and how related are the animals within a pod? The only way we'd know is genetically, and so sometimes there are sort of scientists who go out and take little pot shots at the dolphins just to remove a bit of tissue and collect that tissue. But typically, it varies from species to species, but in a bottlenose dolphin, you can expect a pod to be somewhere in the neighborhood of anywhere from a small group of 15 and then to a collective group of about 150.
Wow.
And they travel together. We don't know if they're matriarchal, but females play a very important role, and offspring stay with their mothers for a long period of time. Of course, the growth period, because they're long-lived animals, they probably live in the wild, certainly until their 20s, if not 30s, So they live together for a long period of time. And then, as with a lot of other animals, sometimes the males split off. They go and find another pod to travel with.
Well, that's healthy genetically.
Right, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes they're kind of chased out.
Do they mate for life, or do they just...
No.
It's just a catch-as-catch-can?
I don't know if it's catch... there's a salacious novel to be written about the behavior of dolphins, but no, they're probably more promiscuous than typical animals that are socialized in that way. But there's certainly choices that are being made, and they're animals that engage in sexual behavior as far as we know, in ways that other animals don't. In other words, it's not merely procreative, that there is some degree of enjoyment. There's homoerotic activity. But it's a very brief kind of encounter, without getting into detail on a morning show.
Is that because they have to do it in the water, and they have to breathe air, and so it can't last a long time?
Well, that's part of it. But you can hold your breath for a good...
You say that the females experience what we would call breech births, mm-hmm. in that their offspring exit tail first, not
right.
head first. Why did they do that?
Well, it developed because, as you said, you know, if you're underwater, you eventually have to come up for air. And the first thing that we tend to do, or most mammals tend to do, is the head comes out first. And if it's a long process, and sometimes the body takes a little bit longer to come out, that child is no longer getting nutrients or air. It has to take deep breaths. But for the dolphin, if the birth takes a little while, it has to come out tail first in order to have the opportunity to wait for a breath.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as they come out, often the mother or nursing dolphins, in other words, attending females, will help push that dolphin up to the surface. And to some extent, we think that may be one of the reasons when, you know, all those stories about people, whether it's Elian Gonzalez or Dick Van Dyke, being pushed to the surface or saved by dolphins, has to do with that innate knowledge that here's an air breather and it needs to get to the surface as
right.
quickly as possible.
And you say that older females in the pod will assist in the mm-hmm. birth, and they create a kind of nursery area
right.
in the water
right.
for that to take place. Gosh, it's pretty amazing. And when you think about all animals, you think about the birth of a calf.
Mm-hmm.
They're on their feet.
Yeah.
Where it takes a human baby months and months to get up on,
right.
on their feet. And these creatures not only have to breathe instantly, they have to swim
mm-hmm.
instantly. What is a childhood like for a dolphin? How much attention do they need when they're...
Well, they're extremely vulnerable. And, again, we don't see a lot of predation, you know, in sort of wildlife videos on dolphin offspring. Mm-hmm. But it's very, very common. They're very small, relatively speaking. They're very vulnerable. They're not necessarily the best swimmers. They're not necessarily well acquainted with potential predators and so on. So the protective community has to be very
right.
robust around them. And so it takes a good long while, and they do stay with their mothers up until 4 or 5 years old, until they finally become competent to be on their own, and also probably sexually mature.
Mm. You talked about echolocation. They can examine you, and they know mm-hmm. a lot of stuff about you just to their sonar.
About us, yes.
Yeah. and about each other.
Yes.
And the things around them in the water. How do they communicate with each other in other ways?
Another way, yes. Dolphin sounds are very, very complicated because echolocation is produced in one area, and it's emitted through their skulls. I mean, the part of the dolphin... If you think of a bottlenose dolphin, the part that looks like the forehead is not a forehead at all. It's not where the brain is. It's a fatty tissue, and their brains are kind of parabolic, so that their skulls are kind of parabolic, so that they can produce these sounds. They radiate through their skull, and they can target what they're echolocating.
What's creating the sound?
There are these. oh, how can I put it? These what are called monkey lips. Okay. I didn't come up with the term.
All right.
These folds within their tissue in their nasal passages.
So it's air.
Yes. Okay. Yes. I mean, so – and then they also have the capability of whistling. And so what you're mostly used to is hearing the dolphins. When they chatter or when they whistle, those are a different set, those are different sounds, completely produced in a different way.
Okay.
And not echolocation. And the thing is that we know about a lot of research has been done on whistling. We can't necessarily tell what they're communicating, but we believe that all dolphins have a kind of signature whistle, so that every dolphin identifies itself within certain populations as Mike Collins through a whistle.
And they're talking all the time, you say. Is it not unlike the fact we've discovered now that elephants produce this really low-frequency rumble that I guess they can hear but that we cannot hear?
Right.
Is that the same kind of thing that the dolphin is doing? Here I am. Here's where I am. Where are you?
Right. And here's who I am.
Okay.
And to some extent, not where are you, but there are possibilities of alarm calls, of notification of food, of danger, of all of those kinds of things. We really don't know exactly what they're communicating through the whistles. And whistles are very, very brief. And what's good about a brief sound as opposed to a rumble, elephants and large whales produce very, very low frequency sounds that can travel, especially some of the larger whales, like humpback whales, can produce a sound that'll travel because the wavelength is so powerful and long, can go hundreds of miles.
Wow.
But a high-frequency sound will only last a short period of time.
Right.
So every sound has a different function.
So it's for short-distance communication that will keep predators, perhaps, they don't hear it because they're too far
away. No, you don't want – right. You don't want to attract –
Do they have something we could refer to as a culture?
Well, this is always when we talk about culture and animals, people get a little nervous. But more and more, we are thinking about animals as having cultures. We think about them with bonobo chimpanzees, or chimpanzees proper, or gorillas. And the question is, you know, what is culture? And culture, to some extent, involves not only communicating with each other, being able to transfer information over time. And if there are certain kinds of practices that dolphins use that are not innate, for example, using sponges certain kinds of new sounds or mimicking other animals, and other animals learn it, then in fact there is a culture going on.
This may sound like I thought this was going to be a silly question, but then I found it in your book, and that is the fact they survive in a very cold, very salty environment.
Right.
All creatures need water. I just assumed they drank the ocean water. They don't.
No. That's called drinking ocean water is called Mariposa, and you never want to do that. Anybody out there?
So where do they get?
That's
about 30 seconds.
Okay. what they do is they get their water out of other animals that are like fish and shrimp and other kinds of mollusks.
Which accounts – you've brought a model of a dolphin that you can see into the inside of it. And that accounts, I guess, for the enormous gastrointestinal tract that they have.
Right. Dolphins eat animals, fish, and all the entirely. They don't chew them, swallow them, and run them through the gut, and then squeeze as much as they can out of it.
We have to take a break. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and McCall Center for Visual Arts Studio Party 14. Party like it's 1999 with over 150 artworks for purchase and preview Aurora Robson's Stayin' Alive exhibition May 3rd. Tickets at mccallcenter.org. And Rooster's Wood-Fired Kitchen presenting catering options from the seasonally inspired menu located uptown in South Park and online at roosterskitchen.com. It's Friday that
That means the weekly news roundup comes our way in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, the National Hour first. Some of the things they'll be talking about: the Supreme Court upholding a Michigan law banning affirmative action, the FCC announcing plans for new net neutrality rules, and Georgia's governor signing an expansive gun carry law. By the way, our guest today, Alan Rausch, is speaking Saturday, June 7th at Discovery Place for Marine Mammal Day. You can get details about that at WFAE.org/CharlotteTalks, and we're coming right back.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper. This week we're looking at the real world of the chef, and I'm not talking about being in front of a TV camera. To be a chef, you need to be running a kitchen, and you need to love to cook. The Spotted Pig's April Bloomfield joins us. That's this week on The Splendid Table from 8 p.m.
Tune in Sunday afternoon starting at 4, right after America's Test Kitchen at 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Alan Rausch is with us, professor of English at UNC Charlotte and the author of Dolphin. He has done extensive work in studying dolphin behavior and worked with dolphins in the past. And this book encompasses everything you want to know about dolphins. However, I am told that members of our elite news department, normally serious individuals who are dedicated to the craft of bringing the truth to America, have offered our producer $1 if you will make the dolphin chatter sound.
There's nothing in it for me.
These people are not well.
What I want to know is what cut I get. I'll just say that I was looking for my comb, and I forgot to bring a comb in today because I'm on the radio. Uh-huh. When you go to an aquarium and you take a comb and you run it against, push it against a glass and you run your finger along the side of it, it creates a sound that's just like echolocation.
Oh, wow.
And the dolphins come, I mean, they're fascinated by it. Whereas if you stand there, because there's glass and glasses and then air, and you make a sound like, they're not going to hear that.
Right.
The person next to you will, and they may give you $1 for it. and frankly, if there's more money in it, I'll do it again.
You know, they seem to take notice of us in the water when we're there, and they seem to like us. They seem to want to show off for us. Are we anthropomorphizing them?
Well, yes, we're always anthropomorphizing any animal that we're with. And it's something we need. Either people live with it comfortably or they reject it. When I first got my dog many years ago, one of the trainers with whom I was talking said to my wife and myself, you know, because he was supposed to be able to sit on command and he didn't, they said, well, Mommy and Daddy haven't been very good with little Manny. And I looked at her, because maybe I'm too serious, and I said, you know, really, Mommy and Daddy don't come into this relationship at all. Mm-hmm. So we do tend to anthropomorphize them, but in some sense, we also tend, and we should, recognize what they're capable of. They're highly visual animals. They can see both above the surface and below surface. We are interested in them, and why wouldn't they be interested in us if we're interested in them? And we make specific efforts to communicate with them.
But a lot of animals appear afraid of us. They don't appear to be afraid of us.
They can be afraid. You were suggesting earlier that you had an opportunity to swim with dolphins, and they came and examined you, but then took off.
They wouldn't let me touch them.
Right. And, of course, why would they?
Right.
You just stepped into their pool. It's their territory. It's their space.
Right.
And basically, they want to know who you are, and they want to get control of the situation. But they're not interested in having you be the friendly dolphin guy.
You say dolphins started out as land animals who migrated to the sea about 35 million years ago. Mm-hmm. How do we know that?
Well, for those of us who are students of evolution, we recognize that there are lots and lots of fossils around that are different forms of early dolphins that have some of the same physical traits in their bones that subsequent species have, and we can trace this pathway.
And you have an illustration in your book of a precursor to a dolphin that looks like a cross between a very, and I mean very large rat.
Yes.
And a deer.
Yes.
Now, and there was why would that creature decide, I'm going to go live as an air breather in the water?
That's a good question. It's not a decision that they make, but it's you get squeezed out of your habitat, and you spend more and more time looking for food and eating little shrimp and little things that are on the side of the water, and you get evolutionarily, you get better and better at negotiating this space. You're probably in fresh water, so it's not too dangerous for you. You're in shallow water. And it becomes a successful way of conducting your life. And you can do the way that a hippopotamus does. And hippopotami are very closely related to dolphins.
Yeah, you said that they're related to the dolphin, but they don't spend all of their time in the water.
They spend a great deal of time.
Well, they submerge, but they come up and walk on the land. The dolphin doesn't walk anymore. They have no feet.
No. They retain their feet for a long period of time. And so that there were probably some species that were capable of dragging themselves out on land. But at a certain point, you get too large, and you don't want to have, if you're that size, the weight that you have to carry with you if you bring it out on land. The same thing is true of a hippopotamus.
Right.
Is almost too great. You need to have the suspension of water.
So they're not just in the water to cool off. They're in the water because it's just easier to be there because they can float.
Who?
The hippopotamus.
Oh. Yes, and it's a great source of food and nutrients, and it's a way to get away from predators who will not enter the water.
But hippopotami, like other mammals, have hair. Dolphins are mammals, but they don't. All mammals have hair, don't
right.
they? But
yes.
They don't have hair.
Well, they do, and there's a picture in the book that I took many, many years ago of a dolphin beak, and on its beak you can see little hair follicles. On some of the larger whales, you can actually see individual hairs, but the larger whales are not dolphins. And yes, they do have hair follicles, and they have the potential of having hair, especially as you see that when they're really young. But no, they've lost their hair. And it happens to the best of us.
They're warm-blooded animals. So they like, I guess, I don't know whether they like warm environments or not, but they, as we said, they live in a salty, cold environment. How do they stay warm? Is that important?
Yeah. I mean, unlike certain kinds of other marine mammals, like manatees, which seek out the outflow of power plants to stay warm, mm-hmm. Dolphins are so well insulated with blubber that in some sense, obviously, they can get hypothermia, but basically they can keep themselves warm in a variety of ways. And one of the things that's a constraint on all marine mammals who have blubber, and dolphins are and whales are the most efficient in terms of having those very thick layers and a form of circulation that can keep blood away from the surface. Mm-hmm. If you can keep blood away from your surface, you're not going to lose heat. Dolphins, if they need to lose heat, the way that elephants lose heat through their ears, dolphins tend to lose heat through their flukes, their tail fins, uh-huh. or through their dorsal fin. But they can stay very, very warm. But one of the constraints is dolphins can only swim, and whales too, at a certain speed, because at a certain point you create so much energy internally, as we all know, if put on an overcoat. And I know this from growing up in Montreal, but you put on an overcoat and you run a couple of blocks and you'll overheat.
Right.
And that can break down your internal organs. Dolphins have to resist that. So you don't necessarily see dolphins swimming or whales at a speed greater than 20 or 25 miles an hour.
And the reason they jump out of the water as they swim sometimes is because it's less resistance.
Right.
It uses less energy.
Yeah.
Huh. Breathing. And this sounds like a really silly question because these creatures live in the water. They're air breathers, yes, but they live in the water, and they've been living in the water for millions of years. Is breathing a challenge?
not if you're a healthy dolphin, but you do have to bring your blowhole, which is basically your nostrils, which move to the top of your head, mm-hmm. Although your brain is still behind your... If you put your finger on your nose and you push your nose right. up to the ceiling, your brain will still be behind your nostrils.
Yeah.
And they have very efficient valves to keep water out when they're down and to prevent water from splashing in.
But as they age, those valves become more challenged, I read in your book. And,
yes.
And they can sometimes get pneumonia because the valves leak.
Right. And or if you're ill and you can't keep your head as high as you might otherwise, you tend to get pneumonia. And if you look, and I've done my fair share of dissections, unfortunately, or necropsies on dolphins that have either washed up mm-hmm. or dolphins that were in captivity and either died from one reason or another, it always looks like they died from pneumonia. Pneumonia is very easy to diagnose. Yeah. It's not always because of pneumonia, but that water sleep seeps in, and it's in the lungs, and it creates a great environment for it.
Their brains are bigger than our brains, and we usually believe that the larger the brain, mm-hmm. the smarter you are, the more intelligent you are. Is that the case?
Well, it's getting back to intelligence and smartness. And again, we have a very difficult time evaluating what smartness or what intelligence means. But what we can say, and the other thing is, you know, here I've been talking about echolocation and processing all of those sounds and making sense of them, of high-frequency sounds, a capacity that you and I don't have.
Right.
We have the visual cortex. We have all of the same kinds of things in our brains, but we don't do certain other things.
Is that perhaps why their brains are bigger? Because
it's
they have
possible.
These other skills that we don't have, and they need that brain space.
Well, and they're certainly folded in, and there's certainly an enormous amount of memory and retention. I'm not denying the fact that they're extremely socialized and extremely intelligent, but I'm always cautious about sort of saying, well, you know, they're more intelligent than we are. They're not as intelligent. They're intelligent in very, very different ways.
Can you compare their intelligence to that of other animals?
Well,
where do they fall in the hierarchy?
I'd say, and other experts tend to agree that in terms of, let's say, the hierarchy of socialized animals who are capable of culture, capable of transfer information, capable of certain kinds of behaviors that we esteem as intelligence, that you have humans, bonobos, chimpanzees, dolphins, gorillas, mm-hmm. And, you know, certainly other animals are very high up there, including elephants.
David in Charlotte emails, Mr. Roche said that a dolphin knows whether a woman has a fetus developing in her womb. Do researchers know that because they've actually tested that with a woman in a tank with a dolphin? And if so, if there is a physical reaction by the dolphin, that would tell researchers that the dolphin knows this. What would tell the researchers that the dolphin knows this?
Well, that's a good question. And we don't know that, and that hasn't been tested. What we do know is it's been tested in very mechanical ways.
I mean, do they treat other pregnant dolphins in a different way? Do we know that?
Yes. In terms of captive behavior, we do see a kind of different response to animals. You know, something changes.
Right.
But who knows? There could be other factors for doing that. It could be hormonal, I mean, pheromones or that kind of
right.
thing. But probably, yes. But to respond to the person who wrote in, the thing is that we can take, for example, large styrofoam spheres, put a lead weight in the middle of them, mm-hmm. one tiny, tiny like a ball bearing, and the other one kind of large, and they discriminate at great distances in a very refined way between those two or the density of the balls
right.
that happen to be in there. So these are very sophisticated skills where maybe, yes, we're superimposing a way that we think that they would be using that, but clearly they're capable of it.
You say that they are self-aware. They recognize themselves in mirrors. Talk mm-hmm. about that.
Well, as I said, not only do they have signature whistles, which means that they identify themselves individually, and it's possible that they can actually identify others through a whistle, but studies in self-awareness, what you tend to do is, and this is true, elephants have self-awareness too, is you take an animal and you put a mark on it, and you put it in front of a mirror.
Mm-hmm.
And what does it see in the mirror? Does it see another organism, or does it see a reflection of itself, and then try to do something to itself to relieve let's say, remove the mark.
Right.
So they use chalk marks in elephants, and elephants tend to take their trunks, and instead of reaching out to the mirror, they use their trunks to wipe the smear off of
wow.
their foreheads.
Wow.
Dolphins, when they see something similar, less of a mark, because it's hard to mark put a mark on a dolphin, but, you know, if there's some kind of suction cup or something that they've – you ask them to discriminate between two suction cups, right, that they can look in the mirror and they can tell that they're – that's them.
Here's a surprising fact.
Yes.
You say that dolphins don't breathe automatically like
right.
we do. It's a conscious process. And I guess that's to protect themselves from breathing before they're above the surface. So how do they sleep?
Well, sleeping is an interesting behavior. They tend to sleep with, we believe, one part of the brain down and the other part of the brain functioning. And often you can see dolphins resting at the surface with one eye open. And the sort of with their heads cocked to the side. Sometimes they will sink to the bottom if it's a very shallow area, or they do this in pools and in aquaria, and just rest there for a little bit. They don't need as much sleep, clearly, as the rest of us, but they also need to sleep in shifts, mm-hmm. so that you need to have somebody,
watching.
Other dolphins watching. And so you sort of shut that part of your brain down for a period of time, and you get some rest.
We've all heard stories about dolphins pushing humans who are struggling in the water toward the shore, or lifting them up so that they can breathe out of the water, circling them in case sharks are around to protect them from the sharks. And we think that that's because they like us and they see us in trouble and they want to help us because we're fellow mammals. You say not so fast.
Well, I don't say not so fast in the sense that I want to explode that myth, but I want us to be aware of the alternative side of that story. So, yes, there are stories. Supposedly, Elian Gonzalez, when he was drifting over, was pushed by dolphins. Dick Van Dyke, as I mentioned earlier, there are a number of people who have stories. And most recently, the long-distance swimmer, Adam Walker, who's a British swimmer, was swimming the Cook Strait between the northern and southern islands of New Zealand. And he was accompanied. There was a shark following him. And all of a sudden, he was accompanied by a pod of dolphins.
But are they as likely to take us to the bottom with them, or as they?
Well, the question is. So the question
very quickly.
Very quickly is we know we get pushed to shore. We get these positive stories of people pushed to shore. But there's possibility that people have been pushed out to sea and they're not so happy about having met a dolphin.
That's right, and we don't know about that because we never see them.
No, never hear from them.
Dr. Alan Roach, author of Dolphin. Thank you for the hour.